installed in cheap plywood like most Soviet government offices, had tall windows that looked out onto an attractive park. Snow was starting to fall again. A police van was disgorging heavily armed riot police in grey uniforms with German shepherd dogs. Both dogs and men seemed to be jumping out of the back of the vehicle with great enthusiasm. We had seen a demonstration by the Ukrainian Nationalist Party going on outside the nearby Parliament building on our way to the Health Ministry, so perhaps the policemen and their dogs were looking forward to a good fight. The English businessman who had brought me to Ukraine was sitting next to me and leant over to whisper that the riot police were the pimps for the girls we had seen in the hotel. There was an inconsequential and meaningless conversation about furthering international medical cooperation. At the end, I commented that I would be happy to arrange for a Ukrainian neurosurgeon to come to London to work with me, but added that it could only be one man, Dr. Kurilets, the director of the obscure and unimportant spinal trauma department in the emergency hospital. This was a post he had been given, he later told me, as a form of demotion, Soviet medicine having little interest in the lame or paralysed. I knew well enough that it was highly unlikely that Igor, low down the ladder as he was, would be allowed out of the country. But it seemed worth a try, and I was damned if I was going to invite one of the elderly dissembling professors. The bureaucrat looked nonplussed, and I returned to London via Moscow that afternoon. A year later, I had almost forgotten the high hopes which I had had when leaving Kiev, when quite unexpectedly a Christmas card from Igor arrived, enclosing a letter from academician Romadanov, asking me to bring Igor to London and show him modern neurosurgery. What had begun on my part as casual tourism became more serious when Igor started to encounter opposition from the Ukrainian medical establishment. After 3 months working with me in London, he had returned to find that his patron, academician Romadanov, had died. Rather than find a new source of patronage and support, an essential requirement in Ukrainian society and known as a roof over your head, Igor proceeded to declare in public that Ukrainian neurosurgery was primitive and backward and that a revolution was required. Matters were not helped by the fact that a somewhat Byzantine struggle for succession to academician Romadanov's post was going on. The position came with important perks, such as a large apartment and a chauffeur-driven car. Igor's own boss had been hoping to get the job, and his chances were not helped by Igor's insubordination. The next few years were very difficult indeed for Igor, as he struggled to reorganize and modernize his department along Western lines. There was a long series of official denunciations, investigations, and threatening phone calls. For a time, he slept in a different room each night. How he coped with all this, I cannot even begin to imagine. I realized that my rather naive wish to help him had caused as many problems as it had solved, and yet I could not very well abandon Igor. So each time that his detractors, as he put it, tried to bump him, to close his department, or sack his staff, I would do what I could to help, although, admittedly, this was usually from a long, safe distance. And when I did go out to Kiev, I knew that I could always escape home again, however unpleasant some of my encounters with senior bureaucrats might be. With Igor's help, I wrote articles in Ukrainian newspapers and staged press conferences. I drove second-hand medical equipment out to Kiev and brought his own junior doctors over to London to work with me. I carried out brain operations that had not previously been performed in Ukraine. In retrospect, given the poor operating conditions and the implacable hostility of the medical establishment, what I did in those years seems to me now to have been verging on lunacy. It certainly required a self-confidence and independence that I was subsequently to lose. Despite the inauspicious start and my ignominious panic, the operation on the woman with trigeminal neuralgia was a great success, and she appeared on the national TV news next day to say that she was pain-free for the first time in many years. I flew back to Poland to collect my car, which I had left with a friend. I had driven the microscope which I had used for the operation to his home in western Poland, and Igor had then come from Ukraine in an old van to collect me and the equipment. On our way to the airport, we made a detour to the Bessarabian Market in central Kiev. The Bessarabian Market is Kiev's equivalent of Les Halles or Covent Garden, a large, circular, 19th-century building with a ribbed cast-iron glass roof. Below is a market, with fierce but friendly women in brightly coloured headscarves standing behind pyramids of beautifully displayed fruit and vegetables and pickles. There is a flower section. The Ukrainians give flowers to each other on any social occasion. And a meat section, with whole hogsheads and mounds of fresh meat. And the rear quarters of pigs, hanging up from hooks like pairs of trousers. There is a directness and rawness, a rough beauty to the place that is typical of Ukraine, but which is starting to disappear now that supermarkets have arrived. Igor told me that the Bessarabian Market was only still functioning because it had become something of a tourist attraction. He suddenly became quite excited and pointed to one of the fish stalls. "Very there," he said, pointing at three long smoked eels in a glass cabinet. He bought one of them and gave it to me as a present. It smelt rather awful. "Very unusual," he said proudly. "They are in Red Book." "What's the Red Book?" I asked. "Book of animals, soon dead, none left. You are lucky to have one," he said happily. "But Igor, this could be the last Ukrainian eel," I said, looking at the long and once beautiful creature who had been swimming, glittering in some remote Ukrainian river and was now smoked and dead and wrapped in a Giorgio Armani plastic bag. I took it from Igor and dutifully packed it in my suitcase. On my return to London a few days later, I threw the smoked eel into my back garden, since I could not face eating it, and I thought an itinerant fox, who I often see walking quietly past early in the morning, might like it. The eel had disappeared the next day, but I was rather saddened to find it later a few yards away under a bush. It had been rejected even by the fox. So I dug a hole and buried it, the last Ukrainian eel, in an overgrown flower bed at the end of the garden. Chapter 6. Angor Animi. Noun. The sense of being in the act of dying, differing from the fear of death or the desire for death. Just as I had first gone to Ukraine out of curiosity, and not from any particular wish to help Ukrainians, although I have now been working there for more than 20 years, I had become a doctor not from any deep sense of vocation, but because of a crisis in my life. Until the age of 21, I had followed the path that seemed clearly laid out for me by my family and education. It was a time when people from my background could simply assume that a job was waiting for them. The only question was to decide what you wanted to do. I had received a private and privileged English education in a famous school, with many years devoted to Latin and Greek, and then to English and history. I took 2 years off on leaving school, and after several months editing medieval customs documents in the Public Record Office, a job organized by my father through his many connections, spent a year as a volunteer teaching English literature in a remote corner of West Africa. I then went up to Oxford to read politics, philosophy, and economics. I